This is Audible.
The Call of Wings by Agatha Christie. Read by Christopher Lee. Silas Hamer heard it first on a wintry night in February. He and Dick Burrow had walked from a dinner given by Bernard Selden, the nerve specialist. Burrow had been unusually silent, and Silas Hamer asked him with some curiosity what he was thinking about. Burrow's answer was unexpected. "I was thinking that of all these men tonight, only two amongst them could lay claim to happiness, and that these two, strangely enough, were you and I." The word "strangely" was apposite, for no two men could be more dissimilar than Richard Burrow, the hard-working East End parson, and Silas Hamer, the sleek, complacent man whose millions were a matter of household knowledge.
"It's odd, you know," mused Burrow. "I believe that you are the only contented millionaire I've ever met."
Hamer was silent a moment. When he spoke, his tone had altered. "I used to be a shivering, wretched little newspaper boy. I wanted then what I've got now, the comfort and the luxury of money, not its power. I wanted money not to wield as a force, but to spend lavishly on myself. I'm frank about it, you see. Money can't buy everything, they say. Very true. But it can buy everything I want. Therefore, I'm satisfied. I'm a materialist, Burrow. Out and out a materialist." The broad glare of the lighted thoroughfare confirmed this confession of faith. The sleek lines of Silas Hamer's body were amplified by the heavy fur-lined coat, and the white light emphasized the thick rolls of flesh beneath his chin. In contrast to him walked Dick Burrow, with the thin, ascetic face and the star-gazing, fanatical eyes. "It's you," said Hamer with emphasis, "that I can't understand." Burrow smiled.
"I live in the midst of misery, want, starvation, all the ills of the flesh, and a predominant vision upholds me. It's not easy to understand unless you believe in visions, which I gather you don't."
"I don't believe," said Silas Hamer stolidly, "in anything I can't see, hear, and touch."
"Quite so. That's the difference between us. Well, goodbye. The earth now swallows me up."
They had reached the doorway of a lighted tube station, which was Burrow's route home. Hamer proceeded alone. He was glad he had sent away the car tonight and elected to walk home. The air was keen and frosty. His senses were delightfully conscious of the enveloping warmth of the fur-lined coat. He paused for an instant on the curbstone before crossing the road. A great motorbus was heavily ploughing its way towards him. Hamer, with a feeling of infinite leisure, waited for it to pass. If he were to cross in front of it, he would have to hurry, and hurry was distasteful to him. By his side, a battered derelict of the human race rolled drunkenly off the pavement. Hamer was aware of a shout, an ineffectual swerve of the motorbus, and then he was looking stupidly with a gradually awakening horror at a limp, inert heap of rags in the middle of the road. A crowd gathered magically, with a couple of policemen and the bus driver as its nucleus. But Hamer's eyes were riveted in horrified fascination on that lifeless bundle that had once been a man like himself. He shuddered, as at some menace.
"Don't you blime yourself, guv'nor," remarked a rough-looking man at his side. "He couldn't have done nothing. He was done for anyways."
Hamer stared at him. The idea that it was possible in any way to save the man had quite honestly never occurred to him. He scouted the notion now as an absurdity. Why, if he had been so foolish, he might at this moment. His thoughts broke off abruptly and he walked away from the crowd. He felt himself shaking with a nameless, unquenchable dread. He was forced to admit to himself that he was afraid. horribly afraid of death. Death that came with dreadful swiftness and remorseless certainty to rich and poor alike. He walked faster, but the new fear was still with him, enveloping him in its cold and chilling grasp. He wondered at himself, for he knew that by nature he was no coward. 5 years ago, he reflected, this fear would not have attacked him, for then life had not been so sweet. Yes, that was it. Love of life was the key to the mystery. The zest of living was at its height for him. It knew but one menace, death, the destroyer. He turned out of the lighted thoroughfare. A narrow passageway between high walls offered a shortcut to the square where his house, famous for its art treasures, was situated. The noise of the street behind him lessened and faded. The soft thud of his own footsteps was the only sound to be heard. And then out of the gloom in front of him came another sound. Sitting against the wall was a man playing the flute. One of the enormous tribe of street musicians, of course, but why had he chosen such a peculiar spot? Surely at this time of night the police... Hamer's reflections were interrupted suddenly as he realized with a shock that the man had no legs. A pair of crutches rested against the wall beside him. Hamer saw now that it was not a flute he was playing, but a strange instrument whose notes were much higher and clearer than those of a flute. The man played on. He took no notice of Hamer's approach. His head was flung far back on his shoulders, as though uplifted in the joy of his own music, and the notes poured out clearly and joyously, rising higher and higher. It was a strange tune. Strictly speaking, it was not a tune at all, but a single phrase, not unlike the slow turn given out by the violins of Rienzi, repeated again and again, passing from key to key, from harmony to harmony, but always rising and attaining each time to a greater and more boundless freedom. It was unlike anything Hamer had ever heard. There was something strange about it, something inspiring and uplifting. He caught frantically with both hands to a projection in the wall beside him. He was conscious of one thing only, that he must keep down. At all costs, he must keep down. He suddenly realized that the music had stopped. The legless man was reaching out for his crutches. And here was he, Silas Hamer, clutching like a lunatic at a stone buttress, for the simple reason that he had had the utterly preposterous notion, absurd on the face of it, that he was rising from the ground, that the music was carrying him upwards. He laughed. What a wholly mad idea! Of course his feet had never left the earth for a moment, but what a strange hallucination. The quick tapping of wood on the pavement told him that the cripple was moving away. He looked after him until the man's figure was swallowed up in the gloom. An odd fellow. He proceeded on his way more slowly. He could not efface from his mind the memory of that strange, impossible sensation when the ground had failed beneath his feet. And then, on an impulse, he turned and followed hurriedly in the direction the other had taken. The man could not have gone far. He would soon overtake him. He shouted as soon as he caught sight of the maimed figure swinging itself slowly along. "Hi! 1 minute!" The man stopped and stood motionless until Hamer came abreast of him. A lamp burned just over his head and revealed every feature. Silas Hamer caught his breath in involuntary surprise. The man possessed the most singularly beautiful head he had ever seen. He might have been any age. Assuredly, he was not a boy. Yet youth was the most predominant characteristic, youth and vigor in passionate intensity. Hamer found an odd difficulty in beginning his conversation. "Look here," he said awkwardly, "I want to know what was that thing you were playing just now." The man smiled. With his smile, the world seemed suddenly to leap into joyousness. "It was an old tune, a very old tune, years old, centuries old." He spoke with an odd purity and distinctness of enunciation, giving equal value to each syllable. He was clearly not an Englishman, yet Hamer was puzzled as to his nationality.
You're not English. Where do you come from?
Again the broad, joyful smile. From over the sea, sir. I came a long time ago. A very long time ago.
You must have had a bad accident. Was it lately?
Some time now, sir.
Rough luck to lose both legs.
It was well, said the man very calmly. He turned his eyes with a strange solemnity on his interlocutor. They were evil.
Hamer dropped a shilling in his hand and turned away. He was puzzled and vaguely disquieted.
They were evil. What a strange thing to say. Evidently an operation for some form of disease, but how odd it sounded.
Hamer went home thoughtful. He tried in vain to dismiss the incident from his mind. Lying in bed with the first incipient sensation of drowsiness stealing over him, he heard a neighbouring clock strike one clear stroke, and then silence. Silence that was broken by a faint, familiar sound. Recognition came leaping. Hamer felt his heart beating quickly. It was the man in the passageway playing, somewhere not far distant. The notes came gladly, the slow turn with its joyful call, the same haunting little phrase.
It's uncanny, murmured Hamer. It's uncanny. It's got wings to it.
Clearer and clearer, higher and higher, each wave rising above the last and catching him up with it. This time he did not struggle. He let himself go. Up. The waves of sound were carrying him higher and higher, triumphant and free they swept on. Higher and higher. They had passed the limits of human sound now, but they still continued, rising, ever rising. Would they reach the final goal, the full perfection of height? Rising. Something was pulling him downward. Something big and heavy and insistent. It pulled remorselessly, pulled him back and down, down. He lay in bed, gazing at the window opposite. Then, breathing heavily and painfully, he stretched an arm out of bed. The movement seemed curiously cumbrous to him. The softness of the bed was oppressive. Oppressive, too, were the heavy curtains over the window that blocked out the light and air. The ceiling seemed to press down upon him. He felt stifled and choked. He moved slightly under the bedclothes, and the weight of his body seemed to him the most oppressive of all.
I want your advice, Selden.
Selden pushed back his chair an inch or so from the table. He'd been wondering what was the object of this tete-a-tete dinner. He'd seen little of Hamer since the winter, and he was aware tonight of some indefinable change in his friend.
"It's just this," said the millionaire. "I'm worried about myself."
Selden smiled as he looked across the table.
"You're looking in the pink of condition."
"It's not that." Hamer paused a minute and then added quietly, "I'm afraid I'm going mad." The nerve specialist glanced up with a sudden keen interest. He poured himself out a glass of port with a rather slow movement, and then said quietly, but with a sharp glance at the other man,
"What makes you think that?" "Something has happened to me, something inexplicable, unbelievable. It can't be true, so I must be going mad."
"Take your time," said Selden,
"and tell me about it." "I don't believe in the supernatural," began Hamer. "I never have. But this thing, well, I'd better tell you the whole story from the beginning. It began last winter, one evening, after I'd dined with you."
Then briefly and concisely he narrated the events of his walk home and the strange sequel.
"That was the beginning of it all. I can't explain it to you properly, the feeling, I mean, but it was wonderful.
unlike anything I've ever felt or dreamed. Well, it's gone on ever since. Not every night, just now and then. The music, the feeling of being uplifted, the soaring flight, and then the terrible drag, the pull back to earth, and afterwards the pain, the actual physical pain of the awakening. It's like coming down from a high mountain, you know, the pains in the ears one gets. Well, this is the same thing, but intensified, and with it goes the awful sense of weight, of being hemmed in, stifled. He broke off, and there was a pause. Already the servants think I'm mad. I couldn't bear the roof and the walls. I've had a place arranged up at the top of the house, open to the sky, with no furniture or carpets or any stifling things. But even then, the houses all round are nearly as bad. It's open country I want, somewhere where one can breathe. He looked across at Selden. Well, what do you think? Can you explain it?
Hmm, said Selden.
Plenty of explanations. You've been hypnotized, or you've hypnotized yourself. Your nerves have gone wrong, or it may be merely a dream.
Hamer shook his head.
None of those explanations will do. And there are others, said Selden slowly, but they're not generally admitted. You are prepared to admit them? On the whole, yes. There's a great deal we can't understand, which can't possibly be explained normally. We've any amount to find out still, and I, for one, believe in keeping an open mind. What do you advise me to do? Asked Hamer after a silence.
Selden leaned forward briskly.
One of several things. Go away from London. Seek out your open country. The dreams may cease. I can't do that, said Hamer quickly. It's come to this that I can't do without them. I don't want to do without them. Ah, I guessed as much. Another alternative, find this fellow, this cripple. You're endowing him now with all sorts of supernatural attributes. Talk to him. Break the spell.
Hamer shook his head again.
Why not? I'm afraid, said Hamer simply.
Selden made a gesture of impatience.
Don't believe in it all so blindly. This tune now, the medium that starts it all, what is it like?
Hamer hummed it, and Selden listened with a puzzled frown.
Rather like a bit out of the overture to Rienzi. There is something uplifting about it. It has wings. But I'm not carried off the earth. Now, these flights of yours, are they all exactly the same? No, no.
Hamer leaned forward eagerly.
They develop. Each time I see a little more. It's difficult to explain. You see, I'm always conscious of reaching a certain point. The music carries me there, not direct, but a succession of waves, each reaching higher than the last, until the highest point where one can go no further. I stay there until I'm dragged back. It isn't a place, it's more a state. Well, not just at first, but after a little while, I began to understand that there were other things all round me waiting until I was able to perceive them. Think of a kitten. It has eyes, but at first it can't see with them. It's blind and has to learn to see. Well, that was what it was to me. Mortal eyes and ears were no good to me, but there was something corresponding to them that hadn't yet been developed, something that wasn't bodily at all. And little by little that grew. There were sensations of light, then of sound and of colour, all very vague and unformulated. It was more the knowledge of things than seeing or hearing them. First, it was light, a light that grew stronger and clearer. Then sand, great stretches of reddish sand, and here and there straight long lines of water like canals.
Selden drew in his breath sharply.
Canals? That's interesting. Go on. But these things didn't matter. They didn't count any longer. The real things were the things I couldn't see yet, but I heard them. It was a sound like the rushing of wings. Somehow I can't explain why. It was glorious. There's nothing like it here. And then came another glory. I saw them. The wings. Oh, Selden, the wings. But what were they? Men? Angels? Birds?
I don't know. I couldn't see, not yet. But the colour of them. Wing colour. We haven't got it here. It's a wonderful colour.
Wing colour? repeated Selden.
"What's it like?" Hamer flung up his hands impatiently. "How can I tell you? Explain the colour blue to a blind person. It's a colour you've never seen. Wing colour. Well, that's all. That's as far as I've got. But each time the coming back has been worse, more painful. I can't understand that. I'm convinced my body never leaves the bed. In this place I get to, I'm convinced I've got no physical presence. Why should it hurt so confoundedly, then?"
Selden shook his head in silence. "It's something awful, the coming back. The pull of it, and the pain in every limb and every nerve, and my ears feel as though they were bursting. And everything presses so, the weight of it all, the dreadful sense of imprisonment. I want light, air, space, above all, space to breathe in, and I want freedom."
"And what," asked Selden, "of all the other things that used to mean so much to you?"
"That's the worst of it. I care for them still, as much as, if not more, than ever. And these things, comfort, luxury, pleasure, seem to pull opposite ways to the wings. It's a perpetual struggle between them, and I can't see how it's going to end."
Selden sat silent. The strange tale he'd been listening to was fantastic enough in all truth. Was it all a delusion, a wild hallucination, or could it by any possibility be true? And if so, why, Hamer, of all men, surely the materialist, the man who loved the flesh and denied the spirit, was the last man to see the sights of another world. Across the table, Hamer watched him anxiously.
"I suppose," said Selden slowly, "that you can only wait. Wait and see what happens."
"I can't. I tell you, I can't. Your saying that shows you don't understand. It's tearing me in two, this awful struggle, this killing, long-drawn-out fight between...
He hesitated.
"The flesh and the spirit,"
suggested Selden. Hamer stared heavily in front of him.
"I suppose one might call it that. Anyway, it's unbearable. I can't get free."
Again, Bernard Selden shook his head. He was caught up in the grip of the inexplicable. He made one more suggestion.
"If I were you," he advised, "I would get hold of that cripple." But as he went home, he muttered to himself, "Canals, I wonder."
Silas Hamer went out of the house the following morning with a new determination in his step. He had decided to take Selden's advice and find the legless man. Yet inwardly he was convinced that his search would be in vain, and that the man would have vanished as completely as though the earth had swallowed him up. The dark buildings on either side of the passageway shut out the sunlight and left it dark and mysterious. Only in one place, halfway up it, there was a break in the wall, and through it there fell a shaft of golden light that illuminated with radiance a figure sitting on the ground. A figure. Yes, it was the man. The instrument of pipes leaned against the wall beside his crutches, and he was covering the paving stones with designs in coloured chalk. Two were completed, sylvan scenes of marvellous beauty and delicacy, swaying trees and a leaping brook that seemed alive. And again Hamer doubted. Was this man a mere street musician, a pavement artist, or was he something more? Suddenly the millionaire's self-control broke down, and he cried fiercely and angrily, "Who are you? For God's sake, who are you?" The man's eyes met his, smiling.
"Why don't you answer? Speak, man, speak!"
Then he noticed that the man was drawing with incredible rapidity on a bare slab of stone. Hamer followed the movement with his eyes. A few bold strokes, and giant trees took form. Then, seated on a boulder, a man playing an instrument of pipes, a man with a strangely beautiful face and goat's legs. The cripple's hand made a swift movement. The man still sat on the rock, but the goat's legs were gone. Again his eyes met Hamer's. "They were evil," he said. Hamer stared, fascinated, for the face before him was the face of the picture,
but strangely and incredibly beautified, purified from all but an intense and exquisite joy of living. Hamer turned and almost fled down the passageway into the bright sunlight, repeating to himself incessantly, "It's impossible! Impossible! I'm mad! Dreaming!" But the face haunted him, the face of Pan. He went into the park and sat on a chair. It was a deserted hour. A few nursemaids with their charges sat in the shade of the trees, and dotted here and there in the stretches of green, like islands in a sea, lay the recumbent forms of men. The words, "A wretched tramp," were to Hamer an epitome of misery, but suddenly today he envied them. They seemed to him, of all created beings, the only free ones. The earth beneath them, the sky above them, the world to wander in. They were not hemmed in or chained. Like a flash it came to him that that which bound him so remorselessly was the thing he had worshipped and prized above all others, wealth. He had thought it the strongest thing on earth, and now, wrapped round by its golden strength, he saw the truth of his words. It was his money that held him in bondage. But was it? Was that really it? Was there a deeper and more pointed truth that he had not seen? Was it the money, or was it his own love of the money? He was bound in fetters of his own making. Not wealth itself, but love of wealth was the chain. He knew now clearly the two forces that were tearing at him, the warm composite strength of materialism that enclosed and surrounded him, and opposed to it the clear imperative call, he named it to himself, the call of the wing. And while the one fought and clung, the other scorned war and would not stoop to struggle. It only called, called unceasingly. He heard it so clearly that it almost spoke in words. "You cannot make terms with me," it seemed to say. "For I am above all other things. If you follow my call, you must give up all else and cut away the forces that hold you, for only the free shall follow where I lead." "I can't," cried Hamer. I can't." A few people turned to look at the big man who sat talking to himself. So sacrifice was being asked of him. The sacrifice of that which was most dear to him, that which was part of himself. Part of himself. He remembered the man without legs. "What in the name of fortune brings you here?" asked Borrow. Indeed, the East End mission was an unfamiliar background to Hamer. "I've listened to a good many sermons," said the millionaire, "all saying what could be done if you people had funds. I've come to tell you this. You can have funds." "Very good of you," answered Borrow with some surprise. "A big subscription, eh?" Hamer smiled dryly. "I should say so, just every penny I've got." "What?" Hamer rapped out details in a brisk, business-like manner. Borrow's head was whirling. You mean to say that you are making over your entire fortune to be devoted to the relief of the poor in the East End, with myself appointed as trustee?" "That's it." "But why? Why?" "I can't explain," said Hamer slowly. "Remember our talk about vision last February? Well, a vision has got hold of me." "It's splendid." Borrow leaned forward, his eyes gleaming. "There's nothing particularly splendid about it," said Hamer grimly. "I don't care a button about poverty in the East End. All they want is grit. I was poor enough, and I got out of it. But I've got to get rid of the money and these tomfool societies shan't get hold of it. You're a man I can trust. Feed bodies or souls with it, preferably the former. I've been hungry, but you can do as you like.
There's never been such a thing known, stammered Borrow.
The whole thing's done and finished with, continued Hamer. The lawyers have fixed it up at last, and I've signed everything. I can tell you I've been busy this last fortnight. It's almost as difficult getting rid of a fortune as making one.
But you've kept something.
Not a penny, said Hamer cheerfully. At least that's not quite true. I've just 2 pence in my pocket.
He laughed.
He said goodbye to his bewildered friend and walked out of the mission into the narrow, evil-smelling streets. The words he had said so gaily just now came back to him with an aching sense of loss. Not a penny. Of all his vast wealth, he had kept nothing. He was afraid now, afraid of poverty and hunger and cold. Sacrifice had no sweetness for him. Yet behind it all, he was conscious that the weight and menace of things had lifted. He was no longer oppressed and bound down. The severing of the chain had seared and torn him, but the vision of freedom was there to strengthen him. His material needs might dim the call, but they could not deaden it, for he knew it to be a thing of immortality that could not die. There was a touch of autumn in the air, and the wind blew chill. He felt the cold and shivered, and then, too, he was hungry. He had forgotten to have any lunch. It brought the future very near to him. It was incredible that he should have given it all up. The ease, the comfort, the warmth. His body cried out impotently. And then once again there came to him a glad and uplifting sense of freedom. Hamer hesitated. He was near the tube station. He had 2 pence in his pocket. The idea came to him to journey by it to the park, where he had watched the recumbent idlers a fortnight ago. Beyond this whim, he did not plan for the future. He believed, honestly enough, now that he was mad. Sane people did not act as he had done. Yet, if so, madness was a wonderful and amazing thing. Yes, he would go now to the open country of the park, and there was a special significance to him in reaching it by tube, for the tube represented to him all the horrors of buried, shut-in life. He would ascend from its imprisonment, free to the wide green and the trees that concealed the menace of the pressing houses. The lift bore him swiftly and relentlessly downward. The air was heavy and lifeless. He stood at the extreme end of the platform, away from the mass of people. On his left was the opening of the tunnel from which the train, snake-like, would presently emerge. He felt the whole place to be subtly evil. There was no one near him, but a hunched-up lad sitting on a seat, sunk, it seemed, in a drunken stupor. In the distance came the faint, menacing roar of the train. The lad rose from his seat and shuffled unsteadily to Hamer's side, where he stood on the edge of the platform, peering into the tunnel. Then, it happened so quickly as to be almost incredible, he lost his balance and fell. 100 thoughts rushed simultaneously to Hamer's brain. He saw a huddled heap run over by a motorbus and heard a hoarse voice saying, "Don't you blame yourself, Governor. You couldn't have done nothing." And with that came the knowledge that this life could only be saved, if it were saved, by himself. There was no one else near, and the train was close. It all passed through his mind with lightning rapidity. He experienced a curious, calm lucidity of thought. He had 1 short second in which to decide, and he knew in that moment that his fear of death was unabated. He was horribly afraid. And then the train, rushing round the curve of the tunnel, powerless to pull up in time. Swiftly, Hamer caught up the lad in his arms. No natural gallant impulse swayed him. His shivering flesh was but obeying the command of the alien spirit that called for sacrifice. With a last effort he flung the lad forward onto the platform, falling himself. Then suddenly his fear died. The material world held him down no longer. He was free of his shackles. He fancied for a moment that he heard the joyous piping of Pan. Then, nearer and louder, swallowing up all else, came the glad rushing of innumerable wings, enveloping and encircling him.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.